I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that software is part of most scientific research now. From astronomy to neuroscience to chemistry to climate models. If you work in research that has not been affected by software yet, just wait. But how good is that software? How much of common best practices in software development are making it to those writing software in the sciences? Patrick Minot has written the Good Research Code Handbook. It's a website, it's concise, and it will put you on the right path to writing better software. Even if you don't write science-based software, and even if you already have a CS degree, there's some good information worth reading in here. Welcome to Test and Code. If you've found value in this podcast, could you do me a favor? Could you go over to pythontest.com and look either in the top menu bar or in the bottom footer? And there's a few links we're going to talk about. Contact is how you can get a hold of me. Newsletter is how I can get a hold of you. And support is how you can find links to things like my book, the PyTest book, PyTest courses, the community where you can ask questions. And that's about it, really. I'd really appreciate if, especially if you could sign up for the newsletter. I'm trying to collect emails of people that might be interested in similar topics. Welcome to Test and Code. Today we've got Patrick Minot.
Yes.
I've actually been practicing some French, like just a little bit, because my wife and daughter speak French.
Oh, wonderful.
So Patrick, welcome to the show. I'm excited to have you on because I'm really excited about this project you're working on, that you've put together. But before we get to there, just who's Patrick?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Patrick Minot. I'm a neurotechnologist and artificial intelligence researcher. And I have a consulting company, which is called X-Core Consulting, where I do things around neuro AI for different companies. And I'm someone that has always been at the intersection of academia and industry. So I did a PhD in computational neuroscience at McGill University. And after that, I actually went to California, where I worked as a software engineer at Google. I was the first brain-computer interface engineer at Facebook. So working on different kinds of Skunkworks projects. So trying to bridge that gap between academia and academic science and industrial research.
Wow. At Facebook?
Yeah.
So at some point we could just, if you glance at an ad, it would count as clicking. Maybe in the future.
Well, I can't really speculate about that, but the brain computer interface project that I was working on, you know, eventually I think there's quite a bit of public knowledge about that right now.
Okay. But,
you know, they're looking at different new novel interfaces for virtual reality and augmented reality. Like, what if you could interact with your devices just by thinking, you know, like,
yeah,
click, and then it would just happen? Wouldn't that be something?
Well, yeah, maybe, or else, but who knows? I mean, changing the way we think, I mean, even mental words, having to do something like that, who knows what the effect is of having people think click 75,000 times a day? I don't know.
Depends on the number of clicks you want to do. Yeah.
This is what you've been doing lately. Did you say you have a PhD?
Yeah, I do.
So it's Dr. Patrick.
Yeah.
Cool.
I try not to pull it to take out the doctor card unless because my wife is a real doctor. She's a medical doctor, so she can actually be helpful. And like a zombie apocalypse or something, like she could do surgery, whereas I'd be like, well, let's stop and think and maybe write a paper about this for the next 2 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Very different.
What did you do in school? So what were your degrees in then?
That's a good question. So I actually did my undergrad at McGill as well in physics and math. So
okay.
That joint program. So all my buddies actually went to do, you know, theoretical physics and string theory and all these things. And I was like, I think that string theory is just too hard. So I'm going to try and solve something that's a little bit easier, the human brain. And and so I did 6 years of PhD, you know, which is that's like life teaching me a lesson right there about my hubris.
How much did you code in college then?
A little bit. So back then, actually, I ran a different, you know, consulting outfit, which is called Five and a Half. And this is going to date me, but this was like doing Flash and PHP.
So
that was my side gig when I was an undergrad, because I, you know, needed to pay for college. I didn't want to take on, you know, student debt. And so that's what I did. I skipped classes during the day, and I had like people like giving me notes, and I would use that time instead to do some programming with other outfits that were, you know, less rinky dinky than mine at the time. I ended up working on some projects, you know.
How much of your life now is coding?
It depends. I think like as you, you know, go higher and higher in the echelons of every career, you end up like programming by doc. You know, you end up like having this incredible mechanism by which you can program things by just opening up something in Google Doc and then just giving requirements, and then eventually it transforms into code. I'm speaking in jest, of course. I do about half my time coding.
Okay. I asked this because you wrote the Good Research Handbook, the Good Research Code Handbook, that I found out about not too long ago. And one of the things I've been interested in for a long time is that there's a lot of people in the world that have to code that are not trained to code. And that's maybe an okay thing in most areas. But when we have scientific research depending on the code being good, it concerns me. So I'm glad this is here, because this is one of the steps in the right direction. So tell me about this project and how it started and whatnot.
Yeah, so this is kind of a long brewing process. So at the end of my PhD, I was doing research on this like new emerging field, which is super cool, which is called deep learning. So I was around like 2012, 2013. And I was doing this project relating, you know, deep nets with the brain, which is now like a pretty like well understood field, but back then it was totally new. And I wasted probably like a year just like trying to get together, and I was, you know, just stumbling upon my own code because it was like larger than anything that I'd really done, and I didn't have like a good method for doing it. So at the end of my PhD, like a lot of grad students, I just said like, well, I'm going to work on this during my postdoc. To my advisor, and like many grad students, I just ended up going to a tropical island and sipping margaritas instead, and then never worked on it during my postdoc. This is like many grad students have abandoned projects like that. So during the depth of the pandemic, I had some free time, and I was like, you know, this old project, I actually think that it's time to make it happen again. And so I had like, yeah, a really old code base, and I was like, I'm not going to use any of that. I mean, I couldn't even make a lot of the packages run. Like Theano, for instance, doesn't exist anymore. And so I just decided to write it from scratch, and I wrote it totally differently. And I was like, this was way easier than the first time around. And I was like, oh, that's interesting, because I picked up some things, you know, doing software engineering at Google and doing BCI research at Facebook that could be applied for doing research, like academic research. And, you know, slowly and surely, I kind of, you know, integrated these practices. And I just asked people on Twitter, hey, do you care? Like, would you be interested in learning about this? Because I think I write code better. And the response was absolutely overwhelming. I got, you know, hundreds of retweets and like hundreds of messages from people like, yes, please, you know, help me out. I'm a grad student. I'm drowning in this technical debt. I don't know what to do. And so there was a real product market fit, I guess is what you would say in the startup jargon. And so I took a couple of weeks off to write it and release it. And the response has been really positive, I think.
Well, it's interesting. So let's And one of the great parts about it is the roadmap. So this is kind of a cool diagram that you've got for kind of the whole website, actually, to talk about how all the different parts come together. But so at the beginning, you talk about setting up your project correctly with things like environments and using cookie cutter. Even that's interesting. And I think that's actually a cool idea for people that just want to get going quickly, is to just populate my, basically, if people aren't familiar with cookie cutter, it's a way to say, I've got a GitHub project that's kind of a template, but it has like templating language sort of built into it. And you ask and answer a few questions, and then it pre-populates your starting GitHub repo, right? Essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
And having that, and then you can, and then it's not tied to it at all after that. So you can do whatever you want with it. If you're like, oh, I don't like some of these decisions, great. But sometimes just getting your, like, if I can imagine a lot of people, I just need to write some code. They don't really care how it's laid out. Just tell me the right way and just do it for me. So that's a cool idea. But then you go through things like style guides and linters and then some coding practices, like using pure functions and separating your pure functions and side effects, and then writing tests and documenting the project, and then social, interesting at the end, with open source and pair programming. It covers the gamut, but there's a lot of stuff you could have left out, and there's a lot of stuff that you had to make decisions on where you were going to go with which direction. So any tough parts here if you had any tough decisions?
Well, when I start on the writing project, I start with making like a really elaborate table of contents that is essentially, you know, as I dig deeper and deeper into the table of contents, it essentially becomes like the whole book itself without, you know, maybe in like slightly less words, but the compression factor is very small. So I think the advantage of doing things that way is that you don't have to do a lot of cutting and the end.
So you wrote this roadmap before you wrote the rest of it, or something close to it?
I wrote a table of contents first, and then okay. I reflected deeply on the table of contents, and then I started. And what I usually do is I'll write, like, let's say, like 5 bullet points, and then I'll write like another level of precision inside of these 5 bullet points. So like, you know, 2 levels and then 3 levels, and then maybe I'll go down to 4 levels, and then I start writing. Otherwise, you just waste a tremendous amount of time doing a lot of refactoring. So I think I didn't end up doing a lot of refactoring for the book, except for one of the sections. Like, one of the sections became way too long, which I noticed. I can't remember. I think it was the documentation section. Like, I was missing, I was mixing like different kinds of documentation. And a friend of mine was like, please cut this. This is terrible. I hate this. And I was like, thank you for the feedback. And then I did. And yeah, you can't think about these, what you write as your babies, because otherwise you just ramble a lot.
Some of the best feedback you can get feels like a gut punch. But yeah, some of the best feedback I've gotten on my writing has been hard to take. And then there's tons of it that's just noise of just like, you should use a different word here. Okay, whatever. That's your thing, whatever.
I find that I get better feedback when I, you know, about my writing. So I also have a blog, which is on xcore.net. And I have a lot of articles on there. I have 230 of them, actually, that date back to 2008. Over the years, I've started asking people for feedback, and I found that I get better feedback when I'm pretty clear with reviewers about what it is that I want. It's like maybe I'll say, like, do you think that this is complete? Do you think that this is an accurate representation of a sequence of events? Do you think that this is helpful for somebody that's coming into the subject and learning about it, rather than like, do you think that my grammar is slightly off because I'm a native French speaker or something? Like, which is a very different kind of feedback. Yeah.
I like that idea. And I kind of did that with the second edition of the PyTest book. I had a whole bunch of tech reviewers that I included that are not who you'd normally think of as a tech reviewer. Like I included a couple teachers, and I said, for them, for instance, I said, I don't expect you to give me feedback on like whether or not I'm teaching the subject correctly. I'm also including these questions at the end to exercises for the reader to do afterwards. And I'd like you to think about whether those are really appropriate if you were going to teach this in like a high school setting or something.
That's great. Yeah.
I like that. Focus on what feedback you're offering. And then now we're totally on a tangent, but with code review also, that's one of the things I like to do in projects as well. Code projects is to have a list of things to tell people what sort of feedback to give. Some things are good, like this function is so long that I can't remember what it's doing by the time I get to the end of it. That's reasonable feedback. But things like, I didn't like your variable name. That's not.
It depends. I mean, if the variable name is really egregious, you know, it's like AAA2, which sometimes people do. But yeah, you have a really good point, which is, you know, you want to tell people like what you expect out of them in order to be able to get good review. And I think that in doing so, the feedback that you get hurts a lot less because, I mean, you put yourself in that situation, so it's your own fault, kind of. Uh-huh. But also, it's just more useful.
So back to the handbook. Have you had any feedback from people, or are people using it? And
Yeah, absolutely. I've gotten a lot of positive feedback, and the way that I actually staged it so that I would get lots of feedback at different points. So I did a kind of a pre-release in September where I asked people in September of last year, where I asked people like, hey, what do you think about this? You know, just send me and I'll send you the link. And it was just like one of those like Netlify, like giant subdomains that moved into the ether after that. So I could, you know, experiment a little bit. And the first thing that I got was from a professor at Stanford, person I tremendously respect, and that has written a lot of like books that ended up being New York Times bestseller and like super famous guy. He said, "I actually can't read this thing because your CSS is broken." And I was like, "Ah, damn it!" like you work so hard, and then. Yeah, you just realize like these kinds of things. So I learned something about the night mode or dark mode in that it's a default in a lot of Macs now, and that you should absolutely test your websites to make sure it actually still works in dark mode because it might not. So that was some early feedback. But through that process, I think I got 30 to 50 DMs. From different people, and I sent them, you know, the link. And at first, I didn't ask them for specific feedback, and I didn't get a lot of feedback. Like people said, "It's great." Okay, well, that's not super useful. Or like, "I didn't like it." Again, not super useful.
Yeah.
So eventually, I mean, I had some questions about how people reacted to it, so I wrote them down, and I'm like, "Please answer these 5 questions and send me an email. And here's the deadline because I want to publish this." And then I got like really good, useful feedback. And by good, I don't mean like, you know, the valence is not necessarily positive, but just, you know, saying like, "I didn't understand this. I think it would be good if you had more exercises. What if you had a project that was like an overview that put all of these concepts together?" And so I used that, and then I went off into you know, doing real work for 3-4 months, and I had some time over the holidays, and I just cranked out like one after the other this feedback, especially this project. The overarching project was a real pain to actually get working, but I'm happy that I did it. That did make the whole thing kind of gel together.
So what's the project?
Now I'm having a blank. It's been a little while.
Is it this Zipsla thing? Zip?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Exactly. A sample project, Zipsla, and I got that from Carpentries, I'm pretty sure. Right. So at first I wanted to do something that was more about my field of research. And it turned out that I had to explain people like my field of research, which I did a 6-year PhD to do. So it's a terrible idea. It's like, come on. In order to understand like what the heck I was talking about, you would have to, you know a little bit more about my field. And this is way too complicated. So other people have done a good job of making these overarching projects. Why don't I try to redo this? And then the advantage, a second advantage, is that people can compare how I did it versus how other people have done it in the past and see like the slight tweaks that have come from it and so forth.
Yeah, and that's one of the things I really like about it is because you don't really, I mean, you do have links some in a few places to other people's projects and work where appropriate. But it is your, this is one, like a way to do things and it's worked for you. And that's, I actually think it'd be cool if we had a whole bunch of things like this this is my approach to doing code in a research setting. But in really any setting and then people can like, tell it's like having somebody that knows how to do this sort of stuff there to ask questions to. If you're like, oh, how do I save this stuff? Oh, go look at this handbook. So it's cool. I like
it. That was a conscious decision to try not to just like giving lists of tools that could all do the same thing. Just show the one method, and if you want to try something else, that's fine, but here's the one that you should start with. I'm sure that this has happened to you, that you're researching a new project, like somebody is like, oh, I need to do XYZ, and then you go into this rabbit hole of researching these different packages and like, you know, advantages, disadvantages, feature sets, like does it work, how's the documentation, like what's the number of stars, blah blah blah, right? And if you don't even know, like if you're just a beginner or like intermediate in this like general area, it's a huge time waster. And if somebody just would have told you, like, just use this thing, you would have been so much happier than undergoing all this research. I mean, of course, if you undergo all the research, you know, you learn and that's great. But
yeah,
you just need somebody to tell you, just use this package and do this like these three magic incantations, and then you'll actually like be productive and get started.
For example, what in this project, at least there's a side note that says the amount of cruft for command line interfaces could be reduced significantly using the click library. That's a cool hint, because I've seen a lot of people that don't want to like explore all the different ways to do command line interfaces, and they just read how to do it with the standard library. And I really want, like, that's one of my feedbacks that I give a lot of people is don't use the standard library for command line interface stuff, because stuff like click and things just are easier. So go try that. I love having opinions, and I love that you included testing. It's kind of important in
that's kind of important in your world.
Yeah. And it seems like it should be really important in like scientific and research code. Is this unusual for you to include testing?
Very unusual. I think that I did like a little bit of a survey of other kinds of resources that people, I mean, I'm not the first person, obviously, like think about the subject. There's an RSC book, there's materials from the Turing Institute, from the Software Carpentries, etc. But I think that testing is always like chapter 13, you know, like the one, like just way after the good stuff. And, you know, maybe they'll ram it a little bit in chapter 11, chapter 12, and then you get to this stuff and then it's the end of the book. But I wanted to me, it's such a, natural experience, to be doing testing. And it's so well adapted to the work of scientists. I figured, well, why don't I like bring it in a little bit? But then I realized that I think that the people that I think that intuitively it makes sense. And the way that I have a quote in there in the testing session that comes from Ariel Roken about how scientists test their code. They naturally do it. So if you're a scientist that's writing software, you know, you check every function that you write, you put like some inputs, you see if it runs without error, and then you see if the results make sense. And then it just goes poof into the ether. Because people do it on the command line, or they'll do it in a Jupyter notebook or something, and then they'll delete that code because it's not the real code. And I was like, well, don't do that. Just keep the stuff. And that will help you tremendously down the line, because you're going to have regressions. And like, so like the first part totally makes sense. And then when you explain to people, just add an assert, like you got a bug, just add an assert there.
Yeah.
You know, you did the whole debugging process. Keep a trace of it, because it's going to happen again. And I was pair programming with a friend of mine, and who's more of a, you know, like an artist, that's more of his thing. And I was like, oh, okay, you have a bug there, let's just add an assert. And he was like, assert? I was like, yeah, so then you can check that your assumptions are true. And his mind just stopped working for the next, you know, 10 minutes. It was like, oh, I could use this here. I could use this there. This would be so great. I'm like, yes, exactly. You've got it. And I realized that in most of the scientific code that I've seen, there's no asserts, unless it's like NumPy or whatever, like really like low level libraries. But yeah, in higher level stuff, like there's, I don't see a lot of testing. I don't see a lot of asserts. And it feels like a missed opportunity, because, you know, people understand like, yeah, double check your research and like all these things. So they're already like kind of doing it in an intuitive way. But what if you automate it? And I think like if people just take one thing out of this handbook, and that's the thing that comes out of it, they're like, oh, I should use assert every once in a while. That would make me so happy.
So you're meaning also automated testing, but mostly just within the like bulletproofing their code, like a function that has some input and you think it's always going to be a list or something like that. You think it's always going to be, you know, a floating point number greater than 4 or something like that. You can go ahead and just assert that, so that it, is that what you mean? Like asserts in the actual code or asserts in the test code?
You can have asserts in the test code, but I was thinking about inline tests.
Yeah,
that basically like give some bumpers to your inputs. One that I really like to do. So scientists use a lot NumPy, right? That's bread and butter. And one of the things that is very, very tricky with NumPy is reshapes, resizes, and messing around with the different dimensions, you know, permutations and so forth. And it's often necessary for doing things like matrix multiplications and so forth. And it's incredibly tricky. So rather than writing it in the code, like I expect the first dimension to be this size, the second dimension to be that size, and the third dimension to be this size. Like, for instance, if I have spatial temporal data, I can write it as X, Y, and T. I can write it as Y, X, and T, which is often happens. I can have it as color X, Y, and T, or color Y, X, and T. So instead of writing it inside of a inside of the comment, just write it as an assert in the first thing. So, you know, if I expect like C, X, Y, and T, then I know that, for instance, like C shouldn't be 256, because, you know, you don't have 256 color channels. You would have 1, 3, or 4.
Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. Just having some teaching people to put some checks within their code just to validate. And like you said, you're doing it anyway. You're putting it in a comment. Just put it in an assert as well. And then
and that just opens up a whole new world. So okay, well, once you have these, like maybe your asserts are like too long, or maybe you're realizing that you're asserting things for test inputs or something, which is a very different kind of testing. Yeah. So why don't you take this thing that you already know asserts, and then just put it in its own separate function that you can test.
Yeah.
Again, you know, mind blown.
Well, and one of the things that drives me crazy is this. So I was listening to Peter Thiel's book on Zero to One. And one of the things he said was one of the questions he asks people in interviews is tell me something that you believe that most people believe the opposite. And I was trying to think, and one of the things that comes up with me all the time is that writing software with tests takes less time than writing software without tests. And it seems like it obvious to me that it takes less time if you're testing it while you're writing it. But every TDD book or tutorial I've ever seen talks about unit testing and saying, at first it's going to take longer, but hang in there because eventually it's going to be faster. Or it's not faster, but it takes longer, but you'll save in maintenance cost. Or yes, it takes longer, but you'll have less bugs. And I see the same thing you've seen, is that people are testing it anyway. They're right, but they're throwing away the code. So the only difference in what I call automated testing and unit testing and what everybody else does is I don't throw away the tests. I just put them in a test folder and keep them. So
yeah. And I think it's similar. It's similar to what we were talking about with respect to writing a table of contents before you actually write a text. It's kind of like giving yourself a framework, and then you're kind of reasoning about it at a higher level than the deep down. So you have like less ways of shooting yourself in the foot.
So write an outline first. That's easy advice to give. It's some of the best advice for writing, and most people are not going to take it.
But you know, if you make it like really, really easy, sometimes the tooling helps making these things. So like the thing that forces me personally to do a lot of outlining is that I use Notion, right? Which is it's like a software to write like notes and stuff. And just writing bullet points is really, 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 really easy in Notion. You know, that's really like what it's particularly good at. And then moving stuff around is really easy. So, you know, if it's easy, then you tend to do it. It's not easy, then you don't tend to do it. It's for the same reason that if you have like exercise machines at home, you're maybe more likely to use them than if you have to drive for a half hour to go to the gym.
Yes, exactly.
I think one of the things that I did in the guide that I'm happy about is that I use like positive based arguments, like the carrot rather than the stick. one thing that I've seen, and it's fine because it is true, like you can really shoot yourself in the foot in a thoroughly dangerous way. So an example that people like to use a lot is this one case of economists that were doing research in Excel rather than, you know, doing it in R or something. And this was at like right before the financial crisis, and found out that if you inject a lot of money into the economy, it actually hurt GDP after a certain point. And that was a big impetus for austerity policies during the 2008 financial crisis. It turned out that they had selected the wrong cell range inside of Excel. And so I had like missed like six other countries. And if you added those, then the effect went away. And in fact, it went the other way. And so, but I feel like telling students, like, if you don't have good coding practices, then you may mess up the world economy. I think it's not a good, like, it's a very like fear-based kind of thing. Sometimes the consequences are dire, of course. But I think like more...
You could kill people, man.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a little bit like, it's a little bit much, right? But I think just telling students like, you're not going to waste like 6 months of your life like working on code that's bad. You know, hate your code every day. I think it's kind of a better, you know, framing for it. But yeah, I mean, these things have consequences down the line if you work on something that actually impacts people. Which, you know, hopefully most researchers work on stuff that, you know, they can think of the impact down the line, then yeah, you know, doing things in the good way and in proper ways is very useful.
Well, that's one of the places actually I'm a little scared of for our future is that teaching people to test. I guess that's one of the bits is you're building up. Software is made. Large systems are made by small pieces, and so you can test the smaller pieces easier than you can test the whole thing. Sometimes, sometimes it's easier to test the whole thing, but so test where you can. If it's easier to test as a system, test as a system. But the pieces that are difficult in are a lot of this data science and machine learning stuff. So making sure that the pieces are working right. And also, like you were saying, they didn't grab enough of the table data. That's validating that your data is correct. It's not really validating the code. But there's a lot of that going on in machine learning and data science, and we're basing policy on it. How do we get to a point where we really trust that the machine learning and data science and AI and all that stuff is really working? Do you know?
In the correct way?
Yeah.
Oh, that's
huge.
There's a whole scientific research endeavor about bias and algorithms and AI. I think the short answer is it's really, really, really hard. And that goes beyond just like whether the code is correct, but whether you're reasoning correctly about things is another thing. I work with, or I've worked in the past with Conrad Cording, who's does a lot of stuff in causality research. So there's this whole area of research which is about inferring causality. A lot of the stuff that we observe in the world is, well, most of the data that exists that is fed to machine learning algorithms is not of a causal nature, right? There's no intervention. There's no point at which like a designer, like a person decided, let's put half of these people with this treatment and the other half of the people with these treatments. Rather, we have these, all this gradient of non-experiments, of observed data, and we have to reason about causality, right? We're like, well, if I do more of this, will this thing change? And it turns out that it's a really, really hard problem that that people have thought about deeply, and there's multiple different frameworks for dealing with that. There's the Rubin framework from Donna Rubin. There's the work of Hudiya Pearl at UCLA. People have come up with different kinds of framework for thinking about these things, but it's very easy. For instance, like one complex thing that can happen is you can reason, oh, like every time that this happens, this other thing happens, and it's just a coincidence. Yeah. Or the causality is actually due to a common kind of causality, and then the intervention that you would use actually does the opposite effect that you wanted to. So that's kind of its own separate research. So making algorithms trustable, very, very difficult in yes. machine learning. It's own field of research, and it hasn't been, I think, like fully resolved.
Yeah, and that was almost a trick question. I was just curious what your answer to that was.
Oh, read. Okay, I'll give you a good answer for like the layman's explanation. Read Hudiya Pearl's The Book of Why. That's a very good overview of the field and the kinds of trade-offs that you have to do in that field.
Okay, well, can you send me a link to this after that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. We can add it in. It's really well written. His more technical manuals are impossible to they're inscrutable basically. But the high level stuff is good. Like the high level like really makes you think about.
Well, I want to give a shout out to you before we wrap this up. Making testing be important at a couple levels, at both the unit level and at larger levels, and making it accessible with your handbook through through the handbook, making it accessible to people that are possibly new to larger coding projects. The idea, the mindset of I'm writing some code. How do I know that it's working? And I'm going to write an automated test for it. And how do I trust the data? Let's put checks in place to make sure the data is what I think it's going to be. And then separating this is just grunt work coding stuff. So I can easily test it, separating, functional coding from, state change code, separating those things, that sort of mindset and having it be a constant thing that people start learning how to do, when they're coding, I think can help bring that mindset up to larger fields so that we have everybody in the industry saying when they see a large algorithm, saying, but do we trust the data and has everything inside been tested? And just that mindset of how do we know that it's working? It's really important. And I think that mindset shift needs to start at the function level and then it'll make its way up to the systems once everybody has it. Hopefully.
I agree entirely. And you're right, you know, like once you get to a certain level of abstraction, like you just kind of assume as an end user that all the stuff underneath it kind of works. And if people don't have those, you know, good engineering practices, then that can be very dangerous, right? Because you trust something and it actually is not trustable.
Right. And that's one of the things I love about you people using NumPy and stuff like that is because those open source projects do have a lot of eyes on them and they are well tested. Yeah. And if there is an issue, and the issues do come up, but they get found fairly quickly. So anyway, cool. Well, so anything exciting coming up in your future that you're excited about?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm... I talked a little bit early on about you know, the field of neuro AI. So I have this upcoming article which I'm about to publish in a pretty nice publication that I can't talk about right now. But if you want to hear about that, just follow me on Twitter, and I assume that the link will be at the bottom of the podcast notes.
Yep. Awesome. So thanks for talking to us today, Patrick. And
thank you.
Good luck with everything. Thank you for listening to Testing Code. Let's keep in touch. Head over to pythontest.com/contact to reach out to me, or /newsletter so that I can reach you, or /support if you'd like to, you know, get a course or something. That's all for now. Now go out and test something.